The American Bar Foundation is an institute for advanced research on law, and it looks as if our intellectual agendas coincide a great deal with yours. And so that's a double pleasure to be here. And I've taken the liberty of presenting today something that's a work in progress rather than something that's finished like one or two of these books, because I welcome very much your feedback. I would like us to consider today three different situations. Situation one, a German corporation which manufactures cars has subsidiaries and assets in 45 countries. The German group gets into financial difficulties, and it can no longer pay its bills on time in Germany and 25 other countries in Asia, Europe, and Latin America. So it wants protection from its creditors, the companies and the governments to which it owes money. It wants to restructure its finances and the organization of company management. So how can it do this in an orderly way and emerge as a competitive multinational corporation yet again? Transnational economic law on corporate bankruptcy offers a solution. Situation two. A Chinese manufacturer located in the inland city of Chongqing in China's west sends high-end electronic equipment worth about $30 million to its distribution center in the United States in another inland city, Atlanta, Georgia. The goods are put on a container in Chongqing, taken by rail to a port on China's east coast, taken by ship across the Pacific, landed at the port of Los Angeles, loaded then onto a train, eventually unloaded in Atlanta. And along the way, the goods in the container suffer about $15 million worth of damage. Whose fault is that? Who pays? And how much do they pay? International law on the transport of goods offers a predictable answer for parties who are involved in such a commercial transaction. Situation three. A corporation in Brazil has developed an innovative solar panel, and it wants to expand its business rapidly in order to capture market share across the world. It needs money. It decides to borrow. Potential lenders want to be protected if the company gets into financial difficulty, and so they want property rights or security over assets of the company. What assets can the company use for security? Its buildings, its machines, its intellectual property, such as patents on the panels, the monies that are due it, that it is due to receive from buyers who have received the goods but haven't yet paid for them, the personal assets of its owners. The economic law of secured transactions is designed to make credit or money available to businesses in situations such as this. A tiny number of international organizations act as global legislatures. They write laws and they create institutions to solve these three sets of market problems. Essentially, these global laws enable or constrain or regulate domestic and international trade. And yet, as Sigrid pointed out a few moments ago, they've remained largely invisible to social scientists, partly because their work is often highly technical, arcane, and complex. But in the last decade, an explosion of scholarship has taken place in economic sociology, and there's been development in the sociology of law toward trade and markets, and both of these have opened up new frontiers of research where the social scientists on the one side come into a relationship with international lawyers and specialists in international relations. Scholars of globalization and law and markets therefore confront each other from different orientations with basically the same question, and that question is, how do law and markets constitute each other? My previous work with Bruce Carruthers focused on cycles of globalization after the Asian financial crisis, between global norm makers on the one side, like the International Monetary Fund or UNCTAD, and target states in East Asia, such as Indonesia, South Korea, and China, on which we wrote in the book Bankrupt. We designated these cycles of legal change after the Asian financial crisis as the recursivity of law. My current work that I'm talking about today with Susan Bloch-Leib, who is a legal scholar, focuses entirely on global lawmaking itself, principally by looking at the lawmaking that goes on inside this organization, but also other organizations that try to make international, trade law for the world. So our book, In Progress, is a sociological or a sociolegal analysis of norm-making by one global quasi-legislature, the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law. Here it is in Vienna, in the United Nations headquarters there. And there we have examined the norm-making which produces the codified norms which UNCTAD seeks to export worldwide. Norms that can be arrayed on a continuum from soft law, which relies on persuasion and modeling for adoption, through hard law, which is binding on parties that agree to it. The principal substantive goal of any global legislatures or international trade law organizations is to become the gold standard, as we say, or the ultimate global normative authority for what we call a transnational legal order. So our research on UNCTAD has used a complementarity of methods, but the most important method is that Susan and I spent about 10 years inside working groups of UNCTAD observing proceedings. I was a social science observer, she was a delegate. We sat for endless hours and weeks in a chamber exactly like this in Vienna, and similar kinds of chambers in New York where United Nations deliberations occur. We conducted hundreds of formal and informal interviews, had drinks in wonderful places, meals subsidized by law firms, and talked to leaders not only of UNCTAD at great length, but other competing organizations. So with these data, we're proceeding in this book and in today's presentation with an empirical and a theoretical task. The empirical task is to open up the black box and to actually observe the global lawmaking in action. We really know very little in sociolegal scholarship about what goes on inside the organizations themselves. Theoretically, we're trying to generate a fresh sociological approach to international organizations, which integrates and extends understanding of the conditions under which they are able to produce laws for the world. Our book elaborates the intersection of three bodies of developing theory. The first of these is recursivity of law, as I mentioned, which was developed to explain major episodes of law reform in global contexts. The recursivity of law is addressed to sociological and political science treatments of legal change in an integrated and a coherent model. The concept of transnational legal orders, which I'm developing with Gregory Schaefer and social scientists and legal academics in Europe and North America, seeks to provide a systematic approach to a particular form of social order, legal orders that cross state frontiers. And that theory is addressed principally to scholarship in international law and comparative law from a sociolegal angle. And the third body of theory, which I'll talk mostly about today, is the political ecology of international organizations. This is a theory being developed to explain which international organizations emerge as global leaders in episodes of norm-making, not only for markets, which we talk about today, but in principle for any transnational norm whatsoever. All of these bear on theories of institutions and institutionalization. And today I'm going to focus on the political ecology with a brief reference to transnational legal organizations. And I'm going to argue that a version of social ecology theory offers a promising way for social scientists and lawyers alike to deal with questions that recur in international trade law organizations and quite possibly in global norm-making more generally. It's our thesis that the legal constitution of global markets derives from and simultaneously is contingent on a political ecology of trade lawmaking. I'm going to argue today that UNCTAD made efforts to build legitimacy as part of its ecological politics, and that effort paradoxically led it into what we call a legitimation paradox. I'll try and show five different ways in which Unzertrau tried to overcome its legitimation paradox, and then ask what the implications are for law, trade law for the world. So let me just say a few words about this organization itself. Because over the past 45 years, Unzertrau has produced conventions, model laws, legislative guides, you can't possibly see that. But here we have tried to organize every product of Unzertrau since the 1970s by its subject matter. So you will see the top three, it tries to deal with international sales of goods, it deals with arbitration and conciliation at great length. It had a series of global norms on international transportation, I'll speak about today, others on international payments. During the 1980s and into the present, it has dealt with project finance and the procurement by governments. It started working on electronic data and electronic commerce in the 1980s. We followed particularly closely its work on corporate bankruptcy. And most recently, it has been working on secured transactions, one of the situations I posed a few moments ago. So the breadth of topics on which Unzertrau has worked has grown enormously since its inception. And arguably, a number of its products have had a significant impact on countries and trade around the world. And indeed, Unzertrau's stature has been magnified since the Asian financial crisis, when the G22 gave the World Bank and the IMF a charge to develop global norms for the international financial architecture, and in turn, Unzertrau got heavily involved in two sets of those norms. The interesting thing is that this organization is a tiny organization. It's based in Vienna. It has about 20 lawyers, 20 legal experts on its staff. They are drawn principally from advanced economies, and these lawyers act as the secretaries to Unzertrau's six working groups. And we studied three working groups, one on transportation, one on insolvency, and one on secured transactions. Each of these working groups sits for 1 week or 2 weeks a year, 1 week in Vienna, 1 week in New York, and the products take about 3 years, up to 7 years, in order to develop. Let me just speak for a moment about the construction of transnational legal orders, the concept that we're developing with, I'm developing with Gregory Schaefer. I've suggested that the general goal of any international trade organization, that is to say, any organization that seeks to develop international trade norms, is to produce a gold standard for trade law. In other words, to create the transnational norms that will govern a transnational legal order that is adopted by states and that subsequently shapes the norms of local actors and then their practice. Let me introduce the concept. For legal scholars and students of international law, the Westphalian legal order was built on two pillars of national law on the one side and international law, the relations between nation states on the other. Modern processes of economic and cultural globalization have blurred the basic coordinates of the Westphalian nation-state juridical system. And so in response to those transformations, we have many different concepts appearing on the global and the transnational. In our collaborative project, we've brought together scholars who are specialists on human rights, on various areas of law and finance, and on business regulation. And we're seeking to provide a framework that has several goals. It'll permit comparative study across every area of law and regulation. It will bring lawyers and social scientists into a mutually productive engagement, which we don't often have. And it may help overcome some of the theoretical problems that we think other efforts have that seek to encapsulate transnational law. We define a transnational legal order as a collection of formalized legal norms and associated organizations and actors that authoritatively order the understanding and the practice of law across legal jurisdictions. We stipulate that a TLO is a socially constructed normative order which is intended to guide behavior in relation to a set of underlying issues or problems, such as the ones with which I began. A TLO for us is legal insofar as its norms either are produced by a transnational legal body, which considers itself to be a legal body, or it is directed to a national or a local lawmaking body inside a state, or those norms are in legal form, such as in the form of a draft statute. A transnational legal order is transnational insofar as the order spans the boundary of states, whether bilaterally, regionally, or globally. Needless to say, TLOs, transnational legal orders, vary in their legal scope. Sometimes they're very tightly focused on a very narrow area of law, and sometimes they expand to encompass entire areas of law. But they also vary, as we've seen, in their geographical scope, not only between regional and global expanse, some focus on sea, some focus on land, and so on. We propose that a TLO is institutionalized as a normal order when two dimensions coincide. On the one hand, there is normative settling at transnational, national, and local sites, and there is concordance of some sort between the norms at each of those three levels. Institutionalization also occurs when there's an alignment of a normative order with an underlying issue. So we can see a fully institutionalized transnational legal order when relevant actors at all three levels, transnational, national, and local, recognize what norms apply in a given situation, and when conformity to those norms is taken to be the rightful way and the normal way of behaving. Now, of course, transnational legal orders rise and fall. They vary in their degree of institutionalization and their longevity. But we see that every one of UNCITRAL's products that I showed a moment ago can be seen as a claim by this international organization to be creating the global norms for a TLO that will essentially be binding on the, or influence the world. So how then are we going to explain the process of norm production for these global norms? We propose to see international organizations engaged in global trade lawmaking as a political ecology. So this requires a shift in focus from a single organization, the World Bank, the United Nations and United Nations Commission, UNIDROIT in Rome, to the sea of international organizations in which it swims. Sociology, as we know, has long developed theories of social space. And these are intended to explain both the processes of a cluster of social entities that exist in the same social space and the fortunes of any particular entity in that space. This theory has been applied in one way or another to communities, universities, to states in the world system, and has shown explanatory power with businesses, non-profit organizations. It offers a rich, conceptually rich perspective, we think, for international organizations which converge on a particular issue area. Norm-making actors, according to this theory, are situated in ecologies. And an ecology is defined as a sort of a bounded space. These bounds may be defined in a number of ways, but we define them in terms of an issue or a task ecology when organizations of various types converge on trying to solve a particular problem, such as the corporate bankruptcy problem. To enter an already existing ecology, and indeed to remain in an ecology, requires that an organization establish its legitimacy. It's got to persuade critical audiences that it rightfully belongs in this space. And we will show in a moment that UNCITRAL tried to combine three different warrants of that legitimacy to get into the space and to stay in the space. Within each ecology, such as the one we study, there are actors. In our ecology of international trade law, these include international governmental organizations, international professional associations, trade associations, international financial institutions, national trade organizations. In fact, if we look here at Table 2, again, probably difficult to read at from the back of the room, you'll see here our classification of core international trade organizations and then the niche for any given industry. All ecologies, including those heavily populated by international organizations, exist in a niche, says the theory, And that niche supplies the resources that's necessary for the ecology as a whole and any organization in that ecology. These resources can be financial, they could be reputational, they can involve labor or infrastructure, political power, or communication capacities. And today I'll focus on one, the resource of time. Now, it's a critical premise of ecological theory that resources are always limited. There is always a competition for scarce resources. And that can lead either to organizations being pushed out of the ecology, or the organization or the ecology itself seeking alternative niches. And finally, we want to argue that ecologies are always dynamic. So alongside the recursive processes that structure relations between ancestral and states, which we've previously written about, there are iterative processes inside and among international organizations by which international trade law proceeds through varieties of incrementalism. And we'll illustrate how incrementalisms not only can amplify the legal structuring of markets, but can convert potential competitors into cooperative allies. Or as ecological theorists long ago styled it, into competitive cooperation. So how do you enter an international trade law ecology in the first place? Ecological theory says that to enter and survive, an international organization must first of all be able to show that it legitimately belongs. Second, find a way of getting resources to be in this niche. And thirdly, to manage processes that enable it to cope with the density of other organizations. The theory being that always there is the possibility that an ecology can only contain at the same time a limited number of organizations. So through these conceptual lens, how did UNCITRAL and its sponsors advance its political claims to be inside this ecology when it was founded in the mid-1960s? Already in the mid-1960s, there were several international organizations involved in transnational lawmaking. There was UNIDWA, based in Rome, a creature of the League of Nations. There was the Hague Conference on Private International Law, a multilateral body formed in the late 19th century. There were a couple of other organizations, UN organizations in this ecology, the United Nations Commission on Trade and Development, based in Geneva, which had been created in 1964 to address issues of trade and development, and especially to spearhead the interests of developing countries. The United Nations itself had an International Law Commission, established in 1947 to codify and to integrate international law. So how is it possible for UNCITRAL to enter into an ecology when these organizations already existed? UNCITRAL sponsors made a fourfold argument. UNCITRAL would be distinctive, they said, first of all, because the bodies already there were inadequate. They were not harmonizing, they were not unifying law in the way they said they would. Second, UNIDWA and the Hague Conference were Eurocentric and were primarily integrated European bodies and had little role for developing countries. Third, existing bodies in the mid-1960s had market economies but did not very adequately represent command economies. They had developed economies but did not very well represent developing economies. And finally, there was duplication and lack of coordination among these organizations. So the sponsors of UNCITRAL said there's a space, there's a gap in this ecology where we can fit in a distinctive way. And to do that, they made three claims for a distinctive legitimacy. First of all, they wanted to distinguish themselves from UNIDWA and the Hague Conference on grounds of a double representation warrant. UNCITRAL began with a widened and a representation of states. Its original articles had 29 countries as members of the commission, drawn from all continents of the world and balanced by degree of economic development. It expanded to 36 members in 1973, 60 states in 2004. But most significantly, in 1977, UNCITRAL invited every member state of the UN if they were not a member of the commission, to attend as an observer delegation. So Onsetral could now claim that it had universal representativeness of the entire world, at least of states in the entire world. Onsetral also tried to differentiate itself from the Hague Conference and UNIDROIT by integrating non-state delegations more fully into its proceedings. So this permitted the Secretariat not only to invite other multilateral bodies like the IMF or the World Bank, but other UN bodies such as UNCTAD, and, most significantly, private industry groups, including trade bodies and professional associations. So with this expansive inclusiveness, UNCTAD had the capacity to draw inside its working groups every actor that had an interest in the outcome of the negotiations over trade law. UNCTAD also adopted as a second legitimation warrant procedural practices that purported to level the playing field. In UNCTAD's practice, any delegation that raises its flag vertically should be called upon by the chair in the order in which it raised its flag. So this meant that, in principle, every country, every delegation had formal equality, no matter what the attributes of the delegation or of the delegate, no matter how weak or powerful the body was or the state was in the international political economy. And then finally, there was the legitimation warrant of effectiveness. UNCTAD pointed to its past activities and said, look how well we have done. We get things done in this body, and we get them done quickly. An overview of its effectiveness can be seen in Table 1, which we reviewed too quickly. What Table 1 shows less obviously are two or three other ways by which UNCTAD positioned itself to ensure it had access to resources. First of all, it shifted its mission, which was originally to unify law and to harmonize law, which proved difficult. So what UNCTAD moved towards a rhetorical formulation of what it called modernization of law. This was a rather brilliant rhetorical move, because now it enabled UNCTAD to deal with practically any subject at all on grounds that it was engaged in modernizing markets, trade, and commerce. So this gave it sort of universal substantive reach. Second, UNCTAD executed some strategies to ensure resources. One strategy was to adapt very quickly to any kind of geopolitical or economic crisis and show that it was being responsive. These included the new international economic order in the 1980s, the reconstruction of the command economies after the fall of the Soviet bloc in 1989, to the debt crises in Latin America and Asia in the late 1990s. And in all of this, UNCTAD took pains to move more and more closely to the United States and international organizations heavily influenced by the US, such as the IMF and the World Bank. Not least, UNCTAD made a very concerted effort to build close ties with non-state actors, especially industry groups and professional associations. So we conclude that by the year 2000, UNCTAD had managed not only to survive in this ecology, to enter it and to survive in it, but it actually had moved into the center of the space where it was exercising a position of relative dominance. It could point around the world to numerous sets of transnational legal orders where it had the gold standard. Ecological theory in particular, and international organization theory in general, emphasizes the construction of global authority on grounds of legitimacy. The very success that UNCTAD achieved with legitimacy, however, threatened to subvert its processes and its outcomes. Because by drawing the entire diversity of interests on any issue into the room, it potentially found itself stalemated at best and in conflict at worst. Essentially, the scope of its inclusiveness, paired with substantive ambitions, tried to get it to go where no other lawmaking legislature had gone, and this was potentially to make it unable to do anything. We argue in this book that Unzertrel tried to solve this conundrum, partly through design and partly through good fortune, by developing five kinds of politics. The first of these, the first effort to overcome the legitimation paradox, was to radically narrow the core participants. This is not actually entirely Unzertrel's design, it was also Unzertrel's good fortune. But Susan Block-Leib and I analyzed and developed a methodology to analyze Unzertrel's data on everybody who attended Unzertrel in every delegation of these three working groups over many years in order to try and see if we could understand who is it that actually does draft these laws in action. We first of all looked at delegations, and when we analyzed delegations, we found that for all the working groups, a very large number of delegations turn up at least once. 149 turned up to transport, 161 to secure transactions, 127 to insolvency. But if we then look to see who turned up more than half the time, arguably you need to turn up at least half the time in order to have an influence, that number drops drastically, down to 56 for transport, 40 for secure transactions, and 36 for insolvency. So who were these high attendance delegations? It turns out that numerically and proportionately, advanced and developing economies are roughly balanced in each of the state delegations, as you can see here in the insolvency working group. 16 of advanced, 13 developing and transitional economies. But the non-state delegations, represented here, I'm sorry, only by acronyms, the International Monetary Fund, the International Bar Association, the World Bank, the American Bar Association, if you put those together with the advanced economies, then again, there's a preponderance of delegations from advanced countries. This is not quite so dominant with the working group on transport, where if you put together the advanced economies with the non-state delegations, all of which come from advanced economies, you get 30 of one and 26 of the other. And if you look at the secure transactions working group, again, there's a kind of a rough balance between advanced economies and non-state delegations. However, we argue that even more consequential than attendance of delegations is attendance of delegates. That is to say, the particular individuals who are members of a delegation. It's sort of obvious, but interestingly enough, seems not to have been analyzed, at least on the sociological side of international organizations. Because in theory, a delegation could always be there, but the same persons were constantly, different persons were constantly cycling through. So there should be a huge difference in the impact of a delegation that has the same people versus a delegation where there is constant turnover. Figure 2 gives you an example, it gives you a sense of the number of delegates who attend. And in each of these three figures, you'll see it's only a tiny fraction of delegates who attend more than half the time. So here's an example from insolvency. 333 delegates, not excluding diplomats, turned up at least once, but only 27 turned up more than half the time. If you look at the working group on transport, 739 turned up at least once, but only 50 came more than half the time. And if you look at secure transactions, 473 minus the delegates turned up at least once, but only 30 turned up at least half the time. And in each of these cases, in fact, the high attendance delegates are coming overwhelmingly from OECD countries at the center of the world political economy, whether as state delegates or as non-state delegates. If we apply an even stricter criterion, how many delegates came three quarters of the time, the numbers drop even more. 20 for transport, 12 for insolvency, and 15 for secure transactions. So arguably, the norms being drafted for the world are in the hands of these 20, 12, and 15 people, who bring us much closer to the core of the deliberative chamber. The delegations with the highest capacity for influence, however, are likely to be high attendance delegations with high attendance delegates. If we put those two things together, the numbers become even smaller. So in the Insolvency Working Group, which met for 4 years to produce a legislative guide on insolvency for the world, only 10 delegations had consistent delegates. Six of them were states: Thailand, Australia, France, Germany, the US, and Japan. And four of them were non-state actors: international professional associations and the World Bank. For Secure Transactions Working Group, that produced a legislative guide on secure transactions, again for the entire world, only 8 delegations had consistent delegates. 6 were from states: Japan, Canada, France, Austria, Germany, the US, and there were 2 non-state actors, both from the US. Except for Thailand and all of those 3 working groups, all of those delegations are from advanced economies. Of course, it's possible for a delegation to have the same delegate at every session, but for the delegate never to participate. What we did in the first half of the Insolvency Working Group is to record everybody who spoke in the term in which they spoke, what anthropologists call speech terms. We discovered that 6 of the 10 high attendance delegations in the Insolvency Working Group were also those who were the most frequent speakers. But what is remarkable is that the delegations from France and the United States together, 2 countries, comprised 25% of all interventions. 4 professional associations comprised another 25%. So 6 delegations, actually 6 people, comprised 1/2 of the speech terms of the entire working group. So from these data, emerged the following conclusions. The number of delegates and delegations at the core of deliberations are a tiny fraction of the world's states. Delegations and delegates from advanced economies overwhelmingly predominate, and non-state actors from advanced economies exert a disproportionate influence compared to the vast majority of state delegations. So these results demonstrate that one principal way in which the legitimation paradox is resolved is through the radical constriction of the variety of interests of actors in the inner core of decision makers. Therefore, of course, we might expect that transnational legal orders built on these norms are going to have a systematic bias. At the same time, we might expect that such a radical distortion potentially confronts UNCITRAL with a legitimation crisis at the same time as it looks as if it's solving the legitimation paradox. A second way of overcoming the legitimation paradox, which is deliberately instrumental, was by creating informal deliberative structures. Part of the problem of UNCITRAL's working groups is that they were bureaucratically rigid. And if it were to maintain its competitive advantage with other trade lawmaking legislatures, it had to move products through quickly. So from its earliest years, UNCITRAL created these working groups, which would function procedurally like the commission. But the working groups had their own impediments. Like any legislature, the floor of a working group chamber is not a good place to bargain, and it's not a good place to draft laws or to make deals. In fact, UNCITRAL's secretariat faced other problems. It had a tiny budget. It had less than 20 lawyers. It couldn't afford to hire expensive consultants. And so it was forced to rely extensively on volunteers. Moreover, if you're meeting for 4 years, twice a year, a week at a time in Vienna or New York, even for a country, that's an expensive proposition. And actually, inside the UN itself, there is a premium on meeting space like this. There is a competition inside the UN for whether or not meeting space will be available for your group. So what UNCITRAL did in order to get around this problem was to create a series of sort of experimental, ad hoc, entrepreneurial, adaptive strategies that evolved over time in combination with the secretariat, with delegations and the secretariat. Here are five of those strategies that created colloquia, roundtables, correspondent groups, expert groups, and inner circles. Let me mention roundtables and expert groups. The Transport Working Group ran into difficulty after about 3 years. The leading delegations trying to push this through said, we're never going to get anywhere at the pace at which we're going. We can't work issues out on the floor. We can't persuade other organizations or other states any basis for a consensus. And so UNCTAD created a sort of a public-private partnership with an international organization and with law firms in Barcelona and in London, so that on three separate occasions it had two-day meetings, entirely funded privately, where all of the rules of the working group could be relaxed and people could sit around in a room like this, delegations, and hammer out solutions to problems. And if you talk to the delegates, they will tell you at each meeting which major problem was resolved at a given meeting in these offshore roundtables. Most important, arguably, though, are the expert groups. None of the secretaries at UNCTAD are specialists in the field that their working groups are working in. They're generalists. And therefore, they know much less about their area than most of the lawyer experts in the room. So each secretary assigned to a working group formed an intimate group of vocal experts that met sometimes during, but usually right after a working group meeting, to advise the secretary, to whom drafts could be sent between meetings, and sometimes there would actually be an in-person working group, expert group meeting. This is a tiny group of people, 6 people, 10 people for each of these. You can see that the results again are paradoxical, because while UNCTAD managed to multiply its resources and to consolidate relationships with resource-rich niches like international organizations that had the money to send people to these expert groups, it ended up relying even more heavily on a very small group of actors, almost entirely from advanced economies. A third move by UNCTAD over the entire period of its history is to solve the legitimation paradox through what we call legal technologies. Now, social scientists are usually inclined to take things like conventions and model laws and legislative guides as inert formal legal instruments that are immune from politics. We argue this is not so. They're dynamic, they're flexible instruments. And in fact, different instruments have different capacities to solve certain kinds of organizational politics. So in its ecological politics, the legal technologies enabled UNCTAD to reach into areas it previously had not been able to reach, areas that were thought too difficult to harmonize or to modernize. Its portfolio of technologies has about 10 different products in it. Let me mention 3. Each of these products has different attributes, and each of them actually solves a different internal political problem and external political problem. So we all know that conventions are multilateral treaties. They're binding in full on states that accede to them. They tend to be highly detailed, precisely crafted, and everybody has to agree on every word. They're directed to states, in most states to the executive branch for adoption. Model laws, on the other hand, are non-binding, or are binding only on states that enact legislation based on the model law. They're also often quite detailed and carefully crafted, and they're designed to be either taken as a whole or to be used as a kind of an a la carte menu so that certain provisions can be taken and put into your own statute books. So in principle, model law provisions are written in a statutory form, and in theory could be drawn directly into the statute book of any country. And then there are legislative guides, and these are amazingly flexible instruments because they're not binding on states, and they're intended to encourage the enactment of legislation consistent with the provisions of a guide. And what they normally have is a set of broad principles as to what the law should achieve, a series of chapters in which there's commentary, and then a set of recommendations. And those are usually directed to legislatures. The properties of these technologies, we deliberately call them technologies, contributed to UNCTAD's boundary making, its legitimacy, and its relative trade its relative status in the trade law ecology. How did it do that? This is a distribution of all UNCITRAL's products over time. And one can see that the repertoire of technologies diversified over time. The properties of later technologies simultaneously made it easier for UNCITRAL delegations to surmount their differences and for states to maintain their sovereign control over what global norms they'll adopt. I can talk more about that later. By adopting or adapting or inventing new technologies, especially technologies that had a higher speed to completion rate, UNCITRAL could increase its output. And so this underwrote its claim to effectiveness and therefore allowed it to make more expansive claims about how broadly it could reach. This also helped, by the way, its competitive advantage with other international organizations. Not least, the variety of different technologies allowed this organization to target different parts of the state, sometimes the legislature, sometimes the judiciary, on occasion the courts, and even private practitioners. So by the 2000s, UNCITRAL had essentially built a portfolio of technologies that enabled it to move quickly in relation to events like the Asian financial crisis and to reach wider areas of law. In terms of transnational legal orders, therefore, it gave it a broader legal scope in its norms as well as geographical scope to the world as a whole. UNCITRAL also developed a way of manipulating technologies. I'm running out of time, so let me just speak quickly to this. Inside the legislative guides, it had different kinds of rules. And my colleague Susan Block-Lieb analyzed 12 different kinds of rules that we summarize here in four classes. Each of these is at a different level of generality. And the basic principle is the higher level of generality, the more inclusive the rules are of dissenting countries. So policy rules can encompass more or less every country in the world. Focusing recommendations or focusing rules have a procedural content, but not a substantive content, so they're easier for agreement. Constraining rules allow major countries with huge differences to say you could either have rule type A or rule type B or rule type C. You can kind of take your pick. And then only the final rules at the bottom, what we call imperative rules, require absolute consensus on just a single option. So by combining the flexibility permitted by its portfolio of technologies and the portfolio of rule types, UNCITRAL gets two political advantages. The internal political advantage is that it eases the threat of stalemate presented by the legitimation paradox. Given more or less dissensus on an issue, it can raise or lower the level of specificity or generality of a rule. The flexible technologies also give it an external benefit by demonstrating respect for the ability of sovereign states to adopt their own norms in ways that are adaptive to their contexts. We also argue that this portfolio of technologies and the variegated form, especially of legislative guides, gave weak actors in the international political economy greater prospects for resisting what critics of UNCITRAL and its powerful allies could construe as hegemonic power. So a price for protection of global norms may have been the use of technologies that are sufficiently open to allow counter-hegemonic room for maneuver and local adaptation by small and weak states. Or, put another way, the technology increased the probability of normative concordance in a transnational legal order between transnational, national, and local norms. And finally, UNCITRAL developed a rather careful use of time, which is one of the most critical resources faced by any international organization. Time, as we know, is both a resource and a constraint. It's a resource because it's a metric of an opening in which trade law can be crafted, but it's also a constraint because, like all resources, it's finite. And we discovered that much of the trade law making depends on this ability to manipulate time. We identify five ways in which UNCITRAL's secretariat and various delegates and delegations began to manipulate time. staging time by influencing when an episode of reform begins, compressing time by shortening the period of decision-making, extending time by lengthening the period of decision-making. But let me just mention these last two, segmenting and multiplying time. Segmenting time is interesting because this is a way of dividing up a problem into smaller and smaller segments. And segmentation, therefore, allows incrementalism. So in the Insolvency Working Group, the first thing it did was a very straightforward procedural model law on cross-border insolvency. And it had surprising success doing that. It then moved to try and take on substantive bankruptcy law that every country had in some way or other already on its books, and it was successful in some way of doing that. It then moved on to a next project, which was to develop law which no country has on its books. And so it was trying to develop some kind of norms. So this is a way, again, to have a series of small steps, each one of which can be successful, which builds up the legitimation criterion of effectiveness. Most interesting, I think, is multiplying time. So the Working Group on Transport, when it discovered that it was making such slow progress, not only created these offshore roundtables I mentioned a moment ago, it actually divided the eight major topics of the convention that it was developing into a series of informal networks. A state was invited to lead each of those networks. Any delegation could belong to any network. So all eight of them worked in parallel for a period of time where they developed their own problems, resolution of the problems, draft solution to the problems, and then brought it back to the working group. So essentially, this was to multiply the time available to the working group by eight. In sum, manipulation of time is a form of power in norm construction by international organizations. Or, put another way, the politics of temporality, we see in Table 7, influences not only who has power within UNCITRAL, because people have different power to make different, create different temporal politics, but also the power of UNCITRAL itself in influencing norms around the world. So let me conclude. I began with the premise that UNCITRAL and other global legislatures exert substantial influence on the construction of transnational legal orders and the legal constitution of markets. Our theoretical goal is to advance an ecological theory of international trade law organizations and to develop a sense of the transnational dynamics of the formation of transnational legal orders and reactions to them. I've shown how UNCITRAL got into the trade law ecology, legitimated itself, in so doing created a paradox, the legitimation paradox, and then subsequently sought to solve that in a number of ways. Let me finish by just making some concluding observations on globalization theory in sociology and sociolegal scholarship. If we step back and appraise UNCITRAL's political ecology on domestic and global markets, what can we conclude? Well, one set of theories would predict that states and private interests at the center of the world economy will be at the core of UNCITRAL's decision-making. And we've seen that it's true that states with advanced economies and non-state actors from advanced economies overwhelmingly predominate. But immediately we have to issue four caveats. Not all powerful economic actors, states, do so equally. Germany, Japan, the United Kingdom, and China had much less influence, for instance, in most of these working groups than, say, the United States, Canada, or Australia. Some key interests were always missing. Banking, the private banking industry, for instance. We see on occasion that some weak nations overcome the most powerful nations, as was the case in the Working Group on Transport, when a block of 20 African nations essentially got the United States to side with them rather than with China. And indeed, the price of dominance by advanced economies may be that more discretion needs to be built into products and more respect for the singularities of states around the world and the particularities of their local circumstances. Another set of theories can imagine the influence of non-state actors on outcomes. Constructivist theory and political science would lead us to expect this. And yes, we find that industry in every one of these working groups was absolutely critical. Yes, we find that professionals in every one of these working groups were absolutely critical. In fact, arguably, they were drivers of the technical process. And yes, we find international financial institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank operating in the background. In fact, somebody said, you know, a key combination at UNCITRAL is for a powerful state to combine with a critical non-state actor, and that is the kind of winning combination you want. Yet another set of theories point to the emergence of UNCITRAL's secretariat as a semi-autonomous actor, not simply reducible to the power of states or to non-state delegations. And we actually see this partly through the emergence of new concepts, new legal concepts in the proceedings themselves, and various kinds of creative decisions that produces new ways of thinking about law that do not arise from any nation state. We partly also see this through the adeptness of UNCITRAL over time. Nevertheless, in some, UNCITRAL and other international organizations in this trade law area rely on similar legitimation warrants that potentially undermine their own authority. So long as UNCITRAL is perceived to be a universalist, representative, inclusive body, it wields a powerful warrant for global influence. But to the degree that the actuality of UNCITRAL's decision-making power is shown to be a tiny fraction of the world's dominant economies, their industries, their professions, and international organizations substantially controlled by dominant economic actors, then critics of organizations like UNCITRAL may be justified in asking whether this organization, and indeed other global organizations that are constituting markets by law, are in fact producing a new kind of hegemony by law. Thank you.